Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 56 on Tuesday, the 2nd of August, 2016. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hello, I'm Andrew.
And despite all the discussion at the end of the last show, you're actually here.
I am. Hopefully for the entire show, as long as the precarious Wi-Fi I happen to be on at this moment in time holds.
It should be just fine, I'm sure. It should be just good. So, yeah, we've got a bunch of stuff to get through, as usual, tonight.
Yes.
Lots of bits and pieces, more from the around motoring than from around than actually talking about cars this week. It seems to have, now that we've reached August, we do seem to have fallen into that sort of slight silly season when Europe is on holiday and therefore not much is happening.
That's true.
I've noticed some of the, we get these digest emails of all the press releases, and it is very much about the latest in tire advancement and stuff, and sponsorship right at the minute. So we're not really using those for inspiration at the sec, but no. but we do have some follow up from last week's show.
We do. Well, this not necessarily from last week's. I think this might be the week before, but you will remember we discussed Tesla or Elon Musk highly recommending that Tesla buy SolarCity, even though they have close tie-ins. And funny enough, that's actually come to fruition for $2.6 billion. And that's all we have to say about that.
It is, really. Other than just to remind people that SolarCity is, of course, a solar energy company. I think that pretty much covers that. Similarly, from the last time we spoke about Tesla and we spoke about the Masterplan V2 that was out then, in case people found that interesting, as we talked through the existing master plan and the future one, then Ed Niedermeyer has written a piece for I've now lost which one what it is that he's written it for.
Bloomberg View.
I couldn't remember if it was Bloomberg or Forbes, but has written a piece for Bloomberg, which goes through it in a bit more detail, and lots of it is very similar to what we said, but he goes into a bit more detail, a bit more of the background. So there's kind of bonus reading on that. Then I can strongly recommend that column. It's not hugely long, but it is interesting and well written, and all the other usual things. If you're a diehard Tesla cultist, maybe not the article for you. But for the rest of us, it's an interesting read.
It is. Right, we mentioned a new project to follow. Major Gav.
We did.
Gavin, big surname. He of Petrolblog. Well, he's actually now started writing on Petrolblog about this, and he has made further progress. So there will be a link in the show notes to see the progress to date, which is quite a bit, considering this is his very first project of such a scale and type. And don't forget the hashtag is #ProjectAX, which you can follow on Twitter. And he is specifically asking for wishes of luck, and he also needs hobnobs. So if you can provide any or both of those, please do. But hopefully, because the Citroen AX is a cracking car, hopefully Gavin can get this back on the road pretty soon.
I'm trying to work out which is more important in car projects, the luck or the hobnobs. Erring towards hobnobs.
Yeah. I think it's 50-50 in this case. But the wheels look stunning. I love the wheels he's got for this car.
Yeah, well, it is it's a GT, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. So they're lovely. Yeah, like them a lot.
Yep.
Looking forward to seeing that.
Okay.
And this week, I've got the Dieselgate follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Hey! this week it continues to rumble along in the background. Now the case is that as of today, the German state of Bavaria has now joined in and is now trying to sue Volkswagen for damages, basically. And the damages is all about the loss in share price, which has really hit the Bavarian state pension fund, they say. It's a weird one, this, because the state of Bavaria is such a big shareholder in Volkswagen.
I was going to ask you that. I thought they were.
They are. They have a place on the board and everything.
Crikey.
That the yeah, such a big shareholder that the 40% drop in Volkswagen shares has meant that they have lost a lot of money, and they're looking for about €700,000 to sort of fill up a gap in their pension pot. It's I don't know. I have mixed views on this. In fact, no, I don't have mixed views on this. I don't really like them doing this, and I'm not the only person who thinks that this is a bit of an odd thing to do. Partially because it's shares, and shares can go down as well as up. And I don't know what the rules are in Germany, but they certainly tell us that enough here in the UK. So if you are going to invest in something, you've got to understand that stuff's going to go down and down as well.
I can see in this instance why, because this was down to individuals' duplicitousness and naughtiness. This isn't, mm-hmm. And therefore the company, because it must be, you know, there's implications of people high up who knew about this, and yet they didn't try and fix it, change it, and stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore the company, because if they are at the senior level that we're talking, as in the board, then they are the company, aren't they? They direct the company. So therefore, they continued the company on a duplicitous path, which is not, you know, and if shareholders had known this, if they were given all the information, they could then remove their money and move it to somewhere else they did trust.
True. And it is a breach of shareholder trust, but still, you've got that. You know, you're there and you invested in it.
If this was Volkswagen decided to do a branch of single seater cars, and that, mm-hmm. and they poured all their money into that, and it went belly up, and that state of Bavaria had the chance to remove their money because they would have known that was happening. They didn't know, you know, and therefore, you know, and that was clearly a colossally stupid route to go down to sell cars, then they would go, well, hang on, we don't agree with how this is being run. We shall remove our money and put it in somewhere else where, you know, we think we will get the best return. Mm-hmm. Because this thing suddenly, you know, the company suddenly loses money and possibly closes. Whereas this, they didn't know, and this information was hidden from them and was kept hidden from them. So they couldn't make full... they couldn't properly make a decision because they didn't have the full facts.
Yeah. You say that. The other states in Germany also have significant holdings in Volkswagen. Lower Saxony, for example, is leaving it be and is leaving Volkswagen to sort itself out in the long term, and believes it's going to be a long-term stable investor. So they, for example, are not making any move like Bavaria are. So this is not, it's not that all the different states in Germany are going to be doing this. Right at the minute, it is only Bavaria. If Volkswagen don't pay out to Bavaria, it could get interesting because state Bavaria, as I say, has a seat on the board. But not only that, but it actually holds a veto on the board. So Bavaria has probably a stronger hand than most other states, and that might cause problems to Volkswagen down the line.
Because that's possibly what, you know, that would be not helping, is the fact that even on the board they weren't told this. So mm-hmm. certain members of the board.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So. Yep. Anyway, that's that. I think that has covered that off quite neatly.
Yes, but not stepping away from Dieselgate, because as a result of Dieselgate, VW announced how they are going more extensively into electrified vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're seeing another step on that is the Passat GTE.
Yeah.
So it's similar to the Golf GTE. Looks exactly the same as a normal Passat GT. The what used to be called CCs, didn't they?
Yeah, the Volkswagen CC it is. But it, yeah. It's so good.
And they're going to start at £36,525 on the road, but then you can use the government plug-in car grant of $2,500, which will bring it down. And you know, there's a claimed range of 660 miles, and it's going to have a 1.4 TSI, and it's going to all the typical hybridy things where it's going to do regeneration of the battery, etc., etc.
All the hybridy things.
Technical terms. Technical terms. I mean, we've had Richard on the show. We know all these things now, almost yes. intimately. It's so.
It is a plug-in hybrid. It's available to order from today, but there's very little information on it actually out and about. We've got a press release, and that doesn't tell us a huge amount, other than some of the spec. But there's barely a mention on the Volkswagen website. So if you are interested in these, you may well have to head around past your dealership and see if they actually know more than has been released so far.
I think that rounds out right. Follow-up in what must be a near record time for us.
Yes. Well, it was a slightly conscious decision, but it's a rounding up around the following up, I think, this week.
Yeah,
nice. But in new news, Andrew!
I am...
Renault Alpine!
Well, I am delighted I could be here tonight, because I feared I was going to have to submit a statement to be read out in my absence by Alan before he went on. About the Alpine. But apparently they are thinking about adding a convertible and more powerful models, which doesn't sound like it needs much contemplating, really. Particularly if you're going up against the Porsche 718.
Right. I know that you don't like this because you find it bland and it looks just like a Porsche, and so you might as well buy a Porsche and all these kind of things. To be honest, I think it's lovely that they're contemplating a convertible and a more powerful model. But just get on and actually show and launch the cooking model first, please, guys. That would be lovely. We'd like to see it on the road so that we don't have to put up with your press pictures, in which show vehicles all in white and make it very difficult for some of us to try and explain. The intricacies of their styling to people like Andrew. Alpine, please come on, guys. Let's get this launched. Let's actually get this in front of people and out there on the road. And that's far more important than muttering about new versions.
I think from a lead in and tease, they are doing a fantastic job of maintaining interest. Considering we don't get to see the vehicles really.
Yeah. But that's starting to wane. Even I can feel it starting to wane with me.
Yeah, it's wearing a little bit.
And that's quite bad. Yes. So come on, let's see some actual fruits of some labours here, guys. I'm sure you're doing it. Let's actually get them out there, and then we can enjoy looking at the car.
Mm.
And admitting
right,
we're wrong
on to you now, Alan.
All these kind of things. Yes. So slightly... from the sublime to the possibly slightly depressing. We've reached the 11th consecutive month of growth in car manufacturing here in the UK, with the best performance in the first 6 months of a year for 16 years. So it was since June 1998. We're up to 158,641 cars manufactured in the UK between the 1st of January and the 30th of June. He says quickly, running through the rhyme in his head to not make a tit of himself. JLR are the biggest car maker in Britain, having just passed Nissan Sunderland plant in 2015. We've got awesome exports. Demand in 2016 is up 14.9% for the export market. Oh, pardon me, I made a mistake. So 158,641 cars produced in the month of June. Okay, let me make that clear. 158,641 cars produced in June. In the 6 months up to the end of June, 897,157 have been manufactured to date. Sorry, I was scanning on through the numbers and realised I'd bodged up. 14.9% up on exports. So 695,139 out of the 897,157 cars manufactured so far this year have been exported. I mean, that's pretty serious. And even then, 7.1 increase in the home market too. These are big, big numbers. They're great. They're fantastic growth. Really good. Let's hope it's sustainable and it continues.
Thank goodness we haven't made any monumentous decisions like attempting to leave a single market or something like that, hey?
Yeah, because that's the worry. If people were to make a decision as monumental as that, then that would add fear and uncertainty into the mix, and that would be a bad thing, or it could be a bad thing. So, of course, naturally, everything has been going swimmingly, as I've just said. Now there's that significant change. An awful lot of the, if not the cars themselves, then the componentry. So 59% of all components in UK-built cars are sourced from abroad, the majority from mainland Europe. So that kind of thing, the import, whatever's going to happen on the import side, whatever happened on the export side, is a little bit scary for UK manufacturers right at the minute. Because nobody knows what the impacts are going to be with tariffs, custom charges, what kind of barriers there are. Mike Hawes, the chief executive of the Society of Motor Manufacturing Traders, is saying, you know, there are incentives that the government could offer. He's suggesting possibly tax credits against research and development spending, changes in business rates, basically that kind of stuff, even promotion of the car industry. Kind of thing. So there are ways in which we could. This may well, you know, it the bad news might not happen, but yeah, it's quite interesting. So
yeah, but we're looking at probably a couple of years before we know the bad news is. So we're living in uncertain times, which we, you know, as you said before, manufacturing and big businesses hate. So the worry is that they just close down the the checkbooks as much as they can.
Yeah.
You know, car prices go up, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, hopefully, we're still sitting here a bit of time past when the original vote has come to pass, making it clear what the 52% of the public thought that voted. And we still don't know where we're going.
Yeah,
we still don't know what we're doing. And except for being fearful.
Yes.
That's pretty much what we're doing.
Sounds about right.
Anyway, let's move on before someone has to take my belt and shoelaces off me or something for fear of disastrous results. Let's move on to news that came out today. This is on the BBC News website, and you'll have seen it mentioned on Twitter. And there will be links in the show notes, where a driver was caught speeding at 154 mile an hour, has been banned for a total of 56 days, and fined not a lot of money, ordered to pay £365.
Yes.
Now, there's two things from this that leap to mind. One, I don't suppose Sia are overjoyed that their car keeps being named, and
it's a bit bitter, that one, isn't it? Because, you know, oh hey, look how fast our cars are.
And number two, that doesn't really seem very much for what is shockingly silly behavior. I mean, that's, you know, more than two times over the fastest you can go legally in Britain on the roads, the public roads, and 56 days and, you know, under 400 quid. Ugh. For someone who's been driving 4 years as well.
Yeah.
Just doesn't seem enough to
me. Yeah, and Suffolk Police echoed your thoughts. Inspector David Giles saying he didn't think it was enough at all. He's really, frankly, disappointed. It's not a real incentive to stick within the speed limit, in my opinion. Oh, I don't know. Still 56 days in prison.
No, just 56 days banned.
The chap played guilt. Chap played. What? I'd misread that. How did I misread that? I read the story twice.
He's been really? Banned from driving for 56 days, has Louis Howlett.
Oh, right. Gosh, that really isn't much at all, isn't it? No. That's a calculating
so not even 2 months.
Anyway. No, that's not even 2 months. Gosh, that's quite something. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Don't think we need to say any more. It's fairly obvious, isn't it?
Yes. Let's move on. Yeah, I just can't say any more to that once you say that. But I love the way we seem to be flip-flopping tonight quite seriously between one type of story and another. believe it or not, we're going to do an Apple story. And the only reason we're doing an Apple story is so that I can say that longtime Apple executive Bob Mansfield has been named as the leader of the very, very secretive Project Titan. Yes, that's the only reason we're covering this story. No, it's not quite the only reason. But Project Titan is, of course, Apple's vehicle-related project. I think that that's the best way of the best way of describing it, given that nobody actually knows what it is. But you know, the fact that so Bob Mansfield in the past has led many of Apple's kind of expansion projects, I think is a good way of putting it. So, for example, he led the Apple Watch project. I think he was head of engineering before that. You know, he's been at Apple for really quite a long time and is really one of the most senior people there.
Yeah.
This comes... So basically, this is being looked at as being a serious move on Apple's part, and they are taking it seriously. Apple, of course, have hired a lot of people recently. People behind Harman's navigation system, Sinisa Jurikovic.
Well done.
I hope. In June, thank you, especially as I hadn't practiced earlier. The other thing that's quite interesting with this is actually... I hadn't realized that Apple had invested $1 billion in the Chinese ride-sharing company Didi Choosing. Again, apologies if the pronunciation is appalling there. The reason I bring up the Didi relationship is, of course, in the last couple of days, it's been announced that Didi is buying essentially Uber's Chinese operations from Uber. So I would imagine that they will inherit a certain amount of what and how Uber does stuff in there, all of which should be really quite a lot of interesting stuff. Should sort of all combine together into there. It just shows that I think whatever is happening with Project Titan, then it is something really, really quite serious. And yeah, it should be interesting. An Apple spokesman did not immediately reply to a request from Autoblog.
Well, that's it. That's what Apple have been very good at, haven't they, with this project. We don't know whether it's an actual car. We've heard rumours that it's the autonomous driving software. There's been everything thrown around because no one really knows what it is. Because Apple are generally very good at keeping these things secret. I think they must do special, they must have special relationships with with countries that are not part of the of NATO, that they can take people and just leave them in in those Faraday cages so they can't communicate out. Yeah. That is allegedly, by the
true,
way.
True. It's yeah, it's yes, that's very allegedly. That's huge chunks of alleged in there. But yeah, it's they've also hired in the past powertrain engineers, battery technology engineers, all these kind of folks, and experts in all these fields. So nobody's quite sure what they're doing. I'm kind of looking forward to finding out, though. But that's just because it combines motoring and technology, and that makes me happy. Yeah. So let's pause for a second and think about the time and effort it takes to put together a show like this. There's the planning, the research, the recording, the editing, the writing up of the show notes, and all the setup and marketing that goes with it. Now think just how much we ask in return. Yeah, that much. So please, a star rating, preferably 5 stars on iTunes, is hugely influential. It only takes you a few moments. It means a lot to us, making it more visible to potential new listeners. Similarly, on other podcast apps such as Stitcher and the like, a rating means a lot, so thanks in advance. Now, before you're thinking that we've forgotten about the Formula E goodie bags, remember we said we were announcing that next week. So, between now and next Tuesday, Andrew and I will be going through the various submissions, the various reviews that have been left for us and that have been pointed out to us. And thank you so much for those of you who have reviewed and who have left comments. It really does matter to us as well as to the ratings. It really is appreciated. If you've already left a review, you still want to support the show, then of course, showing your friends explain to them what a podcast is, showing them how they can get them on their phones, and who knows, just subscribing to the Motoring Podcast would be absolutely fantastic. So, yes, between now and next week, Andrew and I will be going through and having a little bit of a look at the reviews, and I will let you know the results next time. Andrew.
On the show, we do like Citroën, we do like Peugeot, and we do like DS. We do not like how Citroën and DS are pretending they never existed together, but we will gloss over that current marketing fad. Because other people...
I'm so glad you brought that up and not people, me. Yeah, I was going to say that.
In more eloquent ways, have been badgering Citroën and DS about this. So hopefully the historic stuff won't be lost just for marketing purposes. But... anyway, moving back on to the original story. So for the first half of 2016, they have profits in the region of £1.09 billion, which could be anything up to a gazillion euros at the moment. We don't know whatever the current rate is, which is up from £817 million. Pounds from 2015 for the first half of 2015, so that's great news. They've also got a very impressive profit margin, which is 6.8%, which is way ahead of Ford and GM in Europe. And let's put it in some context: Volkswagen, whose figures were announced recently, is only about the 2-3% anyway. So you know they've really, really done well in how they must be reusing chassis, you know, all that sort of stuff, components and that sort of thing, yet still managing to make them feel separate entities.
Mm-hmm. To me, the bit that's most impressive is actually the increase in Europe. Because that would be the area where you'd think that there really isn't any space for Peugeot and Citroën and DS to actually have any leverage anymore. But to see Peugeot sales up by just about 0.5%, Citroën down by 1%, but a huge increase in profit.
Ding, first one of the night.
A Drat. Even on this poor connection, you could hear me.
Yes.
But such a significant increase in profits is really impressive, meaning that, you know, Peugeot especially managed to sell European cars at higher prices, higher margins. Fantastic stuff. Really pleased to see. Really pleased to see that. It's good to have a nice big slathering of good news in here tonight.
Yes, for a change.
Yeah.
Over to you now, Alan, with this one, which is more good news for one specific person.
Yes, it is. One specific person, and that is... and that is that the former Porsche CEO, Wendelin Weideking... Ah, oh, now I know how I got this story. Wendelin Weideking...
no, well done. That's good.
Former Porsche CEO has been... basically, the German prosecutors have dropped an appeal against the court ruling that acquitted him for market manipulation during the 2008-2009 takeover battle with Volkswagen. For a while there, Porsche was making more money from buying and selling stock and shares than it was from selling cars, and was using those to buy up Volkswagen bit by bit. At one point, the Porsche SE holding company said it controlled 42.6% of Volkswagen's common shares and held options for another 31.5% of the stock. Basically, as soon as the financial crisis started to hit, that all unwound really quite badly. And as you're all aware, Porsche is now part of Volkswagen rather than the other way around. So yeah, that's good news. He's finally totally in the clear. He'd already been cleared, but this was an appeal which isn't. Appeal by the German prosecutors, which has now been dropped. So he'll be sleeping a little bit more soundly at night, I would imagine.
Yes. Yes.
You're on in.
But continuing on the Volkswagen theme,
yeah.
I know we touched on Dieselgate earlier, but despite Dieselgate, the Volkswagen Group have manufactured more cars than Toyota and General Motors in the first half of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
To make them the largest producer and seller of cars in the world, which was, if we remember, an aim that is said to be one of the causes or one of the reasons behind the whole Dieselgate thing anyway,
mm-hmm.
was the relentless drive for numbers meant that, you know, if reports are to be believed, that why people cut corners and made the poor decisions they have made, which have come back to bite Volkswagen
mm-hmm.
big time. So it doesn't look like the buying public care too much, really.
No, not particularly. It doesn't seem like it at all.
Having said that, Toyota's production has increased as well, you know, 0.4%, but when you're talking about the across the world, that's still quite a lot of cars.
Yeah, it's pretty serious. It's when it's looking at cars. So it's, what is it? Volkswagen Group, 5,199,000 cars. Toyota sold 4,999,741 cars, and that's across the four brands of Toyota, Lexus, Daihatsu, and Hino, which I don't think they even sell the trucks here in the UK anymore. And General Motors sold 4,760,000 cars, so they were, you know, a good million, almost more than the next biggest. So that's pretty impressive.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
They've done well, though. They have done very well.
Yeah, they have, and you know, it's the auxiliary brands are a big hand, big help in that. And it seems a bit weird to be describing Audi and Skoda as auxiliary brands, but no, it's good news.
I'm sure I read somewhere that Skoda are more profitable than Audi, actually.
That wouldn't
surprise
me.
On the back of Volkswagen's announced figures,
mm-hmm.
financial results and everything, I think Skoda were the most profitable. Were more profitable than Audi, actually. But I don't know because the figures were not that precise to us heathens on the outside. How much of that is R&D and how much of that is because Skoda are able to partake of a parts bin of which Audi helped contribute to, you know, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. They can rely on the R&D done by
Skoda
others.
Get the end results where Audi have to put in the R&D money to put some of that in there. But, you know, what I'm actually stunned at is that the buying public haven't walked away.
No.
Which must add weight to Volkswagen's argument in the EU when anyone comes knocking and saying, hang on, we're at a loss, and people, they can turn around and go, the buying public don't consider that or don't think that's the case in this realm, so please go away.
Yeah, well, exactly. Exactly. Especially these are the numbers from within the period that this was all out and known.
Yeah. So. Right, let's move on to the main motorsport that we follow on this podcast.
Yes, it is about the only motorsport that we follow on this podcast. Formula E, folks. Previews of the Season 3 cars and the Season 3 testing will be taking place at Donington towards the end of August. And 2 days of the 6 days testing will be available for the public to watch for no cost whatsoever. So August the 24th and 25th at Donington Park, then they'll be running public testing of the series of Season 3 Formula E car. Big change for Season 3 from the outside of the cars. So far the looks have always been very much the same So the first two seasons, the cars have looked pretty much the same. There have been changes at the rear of the car to allow for differences in gearbox settings or styles and shapes, meaning that it's been fundamentally the same, but with tweaks because suspension has to be mounted in different places and different configurations. This season, they are changing the nose, so the very, very heavy sort of protectory bits on the end of the wings, in front of the front wheels, is being changed to a sort of more all-encompassing two-tier wing, which actually looks more cohesive and far less ugly on the front there. So they'll be there. You'll be able to see those new look cars being tested. You'll be able to meet the drivers. On the day, it'll be possible to buy wristbands for pit lane access for a fiver per person. They'll be doing autograph signings, all these kind of things. All the things that make Formula E really good to go and see. Now, bear in mind, if you are going along, Donington bears no resemblance whatsoever to any of the tracks on which they race throughout the year, because Donington is very much a traditional racetrack, and it's got steep hills up and down and all these kind of things, and really Formula E tracks don't tend to have that, because they tend to take place in the middle of the city. So I think Monaco is probably going to be the exception to that, because Monaco is back in the listing this year, unlike London, sadly. But that was my first sight of Formula E cars. And how it was all going to work and all that kind of fun stuff was at the public testing before season one. And that was a fantastic day out. And I'd strongly recommend people, if you can make it, then I'd strongly recommend heading along. Access to testing is first come, first serve basis. They do ask you to register your interest on their website, to which I'm sure there'll be a link not just to this motoring research story, but also to the registration page. So yeah, that should be good. As I say, if you're interested in Formula E, if you're in that part of the country, if you want to take the kids out for a day, there are far worse ways to do it than heading up to Donington.
'Tis true.
Andrew.
'Tis true.
More, it's true. moving on from electric news, the Chinese are up to something really quite scary.
Yes, you may have seen being banding around on Twitter a little while ago. There were some drawings of a... Oh, they're calling it a bus, but it's a sort of a... more like a large... I mean, I suppose buses... It's not a bus because it's it runs in a straight line generally. They're not... I mean, it's not a tram because they do have, you know, normal wheels and stuff, but it's raised up, so it's very futuristic in its appearance, where that it's got quite slab sides of which the wheels are on the bottom of, and then there's nothing for quite a tall distance, and then there's the bit that holds the passengers. This will enable the bus to drive over the top of cars or cyclists. And now this is being tested in China. I'm not going to try and pronounce the name of the town, city that it's being tested in. But it's being tested in China. Now, you probably wouldn't... Well, most city dwellers probably wouldn't notice this in the rear view mirror because they're busy looking at the rear bumper of the car in front of them. This thing suddenly comes over the top of you, you're going to get a little worried. I think I was going to say naughty words then.
Well, you need wipeable seats. Worried. I think you'd need wipeable seats. I know that I would.
Yeah, quite, you know, in spare clothing. And the risk is that people suddenly panic and drag on the steering wheel and hit the accelerator and go into the side of these things inside them. I mean, I can sort of see from a practical point of view why they're trying to do it. It's going to take some education of road users to not have panics and stuff. Maybe that is the solution. I mean, well, maybe that's the first step.
Yeah, so we'll put a link to the China Xinhua News tweet about this and the accompanying pictures because I don't know. It's not making me feel any better about it, but it is like... To give you an idea of the scale, it is like an airport sort of waiting departure lounge inside. It's that kind of size. And it's just terrifying. Really terrifying.
Yes.
So, it's cool. It's cool, but cool, but terrifying. So, yeah. That's a fun one. Which brings us on to this week's List of the Week. So, this week, on our hunt for a list, the one that really caught my eye was on Petrolicious, and it's their list of the 10 best classic cars to drive daily. So, let me run through the cars, and naturally, of course, there'll be a link to the article in the show notes. But their aim is to... their aim with this one was just to come up with what they reckoned were classic cars that would be tough enough, reliable enough, and to an extent comfortable enough to drive daily, and to include a spread from really quite costly to, hey, I could have one of those. So in at number 10 is the Mercedes-Benz W113. That's the Pagoda Type SL. Absolutely stunning car. I know David Coulthard has one, actually. But absolutely gorgeous vehicles. And, yeah, you actually do see them being daily driven in London. So I think that's awesome. Number 9 is the Volvo 242. So that was the American market, bearing in mind Petrolicious is an American-based website. The American market, Volvo 240, but the 240 Turbo. Essentially, both in saloon and coupe format as well. So, yep, you can imagine that one. Number 8, an original, a proper, an Isigonis Mini. I don't even need to explain why an Isigonis Mini is an awesome daily driver, because they're just awesome. Number 7, a Volkswagen Golf Mark 1, or even a Mark 2, if you can find ones that haven't been stanced and airbagged and abused in any other similar way, then these are absolutely, absolutely fantastic cards for daily driving. Number six is probably my favourite on the list, actually, and is the only off-roader. It's the Toyota FJ60. So that's the 1980s Toyota Land Cruiser, not the sort of North African Warlords model, but the sort of wider, sort of more estate car type model. Absolutely genius, those. Go anywhere and just won't break, as long as the rust doesn't get to them first. Number five, Ford Mustang, which is the 1964.5 to the 1966 model, the original pony car in there, if you can get hold of those. Number four is the Mazda Miata MX-5, Mark 1 MX-5. Well, yeah, of course, that's a no-brainer. Number three, the... is that MX bias on my part? I don't know. Number three, the 105 and 115 series Alfa Romeos. So these are... Now, I can never get the correct term for these. But they are the ones that are achingly pretty. They sort of Gillettas. I am absolutely not an Alfa expert.
No, possibly. They look a bit that way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very, very ashamed that my knowledge of Alfa Romeos isn't completely extensive and exhaustive, and I apologise to everyone. But as I've never owned one, I can't be called a true petrolhead anyway.
No, well, I fall into the same category. It's the one which has the most beautiful alloy wheels, I believe, ever, and I know there's one for sale about half a mile from mine. Yes, which for about, what's it, 34 grand, I think it is. Fully restored, absolutely gorgeous. I'm not sure I would ever daily drive it in the UK. Maybe in California. number two, the Datsun 240Z. So, yeah, if you want all the looks from all the great cars, a little bit of, you know, if you want a little bit of E-Type, a little bit of BMW 508, 507, then that's the car to have. Again, as long as the rust hasn't got it here in the UK. And finally, number one is the original Honda Civic CRX. Okay, if you can find one that hasn't...
I wanted one of these when I was younger. I really did.
They are so cool. I still do want one of these.
I never had the money or the to get one at the time when I could have got one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are terminally cool cars, the original Honda Civic CRX or coupes. I prefer the slightly later one, which is slightly rounder and had that lower window in the back. You know, it had the two windows, top one, the bottom one. Yeah, really cool. I think that's a really awesome number one in there. Yeah, you can feel the VTEC just kick in, with that Honda Civic. If you want a bit more analysis behind those rather than my wittering the way through, again, as ever, a link to Petrolicious article will be in the show notes.
Will indeedy.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so let's move on. Now, we on this podcast are fans of Ralph Hosier's work.
We are.
And we feel he is very selfish that he doesn't write more, put more content out there, where he's busy doing good works. So selfish.
Yeah.
But he wrote last week, I think this was, discussing autonomous cars. And he made some, you know, very sensible points, actually, which is why I've included it in here. And there will be a link to this, so you can go and read it in the show notes, which I thoroughly recommend that you do. But essentially, he's saying, you know, for most people, cars are just a tool. They're a white good, they're to get them somewhere, they're to do a job, and that's all they're really bothered about. So for them, autonomous cars actually makes a lot of sense. But he rounds out the article by saying that what we need to be careful of, and what we need to really consider, is to what level we want the technology and the machine to do things for us. How much we want it to step in. And we need to be having a debate about that, not just accepting what's thrown at us. And we need to consider carefully, oh, you know, lane departure is one thing, but to steer for us all the time, is that necessarily the way we want to go? Or to take over when it feels we're making a dangerous move, yet we feel we're in control and therefore we overreact, and, you know, all these other, all sorts of factors come into play that perhaps we haven't thought through. Oh, no, we probably haven't thought through, not possibly, but we can't have thought through yet. So we need to be having a conversation about this. We need to be considering it. And it needs to take into account the majority to a large degree, which is people who just need to, I'm doing my commute on a Monday morning, just get me there, make it as stress-free as possible, please, and then bring me home again. Because, you know what, I'm doing a job I can't stand, I'm on a road I don't want to be on, this, I don't need any more hassles. So therefore, you know, autonomous cars in that instance makes perfect sense. And if I had to do a big commute, I would totally be with people, totally be wanting an autonomous car.
Mm.
But we do need to consider these things, and we need to. We're not having discussions. We're being given things, and being told this is what you want, and we're not. We're not being engaged in this, I don't think.
I like his point about. I like his point about the way that people are, that he's scared of the way people are losing the ability to do things for themselves. And they just can't, it seems as though people just can't be bothered solving problems. I like the line about it, the first thought when a problem hits now seems to be, who should I call about this problem? And not what it should be, which is, what can I do to solve this problem? And I see that happening more and more. I think there's some really lovely points in this. It's beautifully written, and I think it is incredibly realistic. I think it's a crack. Strongly recommend people have, you know, take a couple of minutes just to give that wee read if they're, you know, it's good lunchtime reading that.
Yep.
So. Next up is something from the spoiled brat bucket. this one amazed me. This is in here because I followed the tweet.
Stunned?
I was stunned. I followed the tweet thinking, oh, I wonder what this will be. This will just be some rubbish or whatever. And then I read it and thought, goodness, this is special. Because this is a story on carscoops.com. About the car collector suing Ferrari for not selling him the forthcoming convertible version of the LaFerrari, which is thought to be called the Aperta, but nobody's quite sure yet. So just always a small pinch of Italian salt when people refer to it as an Aperta. It's a chap called, it's an entrepreneur, former racing driver, well-known car collector. A chap called Preston Hen, who basically tried lots and lots of things to get Ferrari to sell him this latest version of the LaFerrari. Now he already has, supposedly, he's already had a large number of Ferraris since 1960, and those have included F40s, F50s, Enzos, LaFerraris, 458 Specialis, 275 GTB, Daytona Spiders, even a Maserati MC12, and one of Michael Schumacher's Formula One cars. But that wasn't enough. So he sent a check for $1 million to Maranello in the name of Sergio Marchionne, our mate, Sergi, accompanied by a letter in which he showed his love. Ferrari naturally returned the check with a short letter informing him that all examples had been sold out. So what do you do when you're told that everything has been, all of something has been sold out? Well, of course, what you do is you sue the manufacturer, demanding a trial by a jury and damages in excess of $75,000, claiming that denying you the opportunity to buy the supercar of your choice has embarrassed him.
Oh dear, I expect us to get sued then.
Yes, yes. The publication...
For reading out sections of this article. Oh no.
Yeah, so...
Oh no, I mean... How is it... When you're sipping your champagne and someone says you can't have that Ferrari.
I know, it must... It happens to me every week, mate. Mostly because I can afford a bottle of champagne, but I can't afford a Ferrari.
Is that what you console yourself in?
There are worse ways. So yeah, from the document which was originally published by Auto Week, it says it quotes that the publication of the statement of Preston Hen is not qualified to purchase a LaFerrari Spider is an untrue statement, which harms Hen's reputation, holds him up to ridicule, disrespect, and disrepute in his profession, trade, occupation, avocation, and amongst his friends and business and social associates. Really? Really? If people are ridiculing you because you cannot buy the latest special edition Ferrari, then here's a hint, folks. Don't spend time with those people. And if you are trying to impress those people, you're doing it wrong.
From that statement, are we then to jump to the conclusion that perhaps he made a bet with someone that he could get this yet unnamed special Ferrari?
Possibly.
And bad. Now that he's out of pocket, he's going, oh dear, that's not good.
Well, that is quite possible, actually. Quite possible. The worry, of course, is that if somehow he wins this battle in court, then he will create a precedent which will be followed by other supercar people in the future. So, you know, just about anyone who has lots of money can demand that people buy stuff, people build stuff for them. Yeah. Which is just a bit. Really, priorities, folks.
What a silly Billy.
What a silly Billy, yes, quite. So, yeah, there's a link to the story which I've discovered, Car Scoops, from there, then, of course, there's the original Auto Week article as well. Yeah, special people.
Right, I think we're nearly done. We've got one more thing to add, though, haven't we, Alan?
We have, yes. The and finally.
Now going into our and finally section. We mentioned last week, after bringing up the Project AX moment, that perhaps we could do with broadening our horizon as far as cars, manufacturers, and countries from which cars have come from should be restored. And lo and behold, the very next day, Mr. at Peter Griffiths with two S's at the end started showing pictures for the hashtag E30 Revival, which is his car, a touring as well, which he's trying to get in a roadworthy state. Now this will only be on Twitter at the moment because I don't think he has a website. And he's a lovely chap who's a mad petrol head. And we've met at Great Escapes. I've met him a couple of times there. He's a good chap to follow on Twitter if you don't already, so go and do that. But we will be adding this now to our near virtual garage of restoration, I think is what we should start.
Yes, I like it. It's all the joys of restoration without having to take the money out of our pockets. That works for me.
Yes, quite like it. But no, seriously, do go. We will be following up on this one. When he posts it up on Twitter, we will let you know what's going on. So that's it's good that we've got a different car to follow.
Yep, exactly. One that isn't small and French.
Exactly.
Not that I dislike small French cars. So if anybody is going to be doing up a Mark 1 Renault Twingo or anything, you know, just so we've got almost the whole set, then if they could let us know, we'll follow that one too. But that's great stuff. Which I think brings us to the end of this week's show, really, doesn't it?
I think it does eventually, following beatings of Skype and my near death under this duvet in this room. The things I do for you, dear listener.
Yeah, he did actually send me a picture.
That you
Andrew
fortunately
is
don't have
actually,
to see. That you don't have
actually,
to see.
Which I will bribe him to stop me forwarding on as he sits there and removes it from Slack. But yeah, Andrew is actually recording from under a duvet. Okay, which is one more than my usual pillow behind the microphone in the hotel room setup, which is what I have today. Before we finished up, we just wanted to ask you something, listeners. And that was about show length. So some of our shows have been really quite long lately. You know, we've been hitting the hour and 15, hour and 30 minutes, just because there's been that much stuff to talk about. Our original aim with this was to go somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour. And we just want your feedback, if you don't mind, just to let us know whether you prefer the longer shows, whether you prefer the shorter shows, or whether, frankly, you don't actually care.
Yes, that's the option C. You don't mind at all. You will still listen, maybe over various stops in your listening. Because I can't. Yeah. I don't expect anyone sits there and listens to an hour and a half of us in one go, unless they're particular sadists
or have longer
or
car
very
journeys.
Long journey.
Yes, or have longer journeys, which is kind of how I normally do it. So yeah, believe it or not, I do actually re-listen, folks, and mostly I re-listen to try and remind myself what I've said in these. So if you could let us know your thoughts. Are we, you know, do you prefer longer, prefer shorter, like don't care? Then that would be just great. As well as that feedback, don't forget that you can share any other feedback you have, share your thoughts with the show at Motoring Podcast on Twitter and on Instagram, on Facebook, or on the contact page of motoringpodcast.com, which continues to be the hub of all our activities. Please don't forget to leave a review and a rating on iTunes or however your podcast app lets you do such a thing. It really does matter. And of course, we'll be announcing the winners of the Formula League goodie bags next week. Andrew, best way to get in touch with you?
Best way would be via Twitter, where you can find me under @crackedwindscreen. And Alan, if people want to get in touch with you personally.
Well, I'm not under a duvet, but I yes. am under @AJPBradley on Twitter as well. That works just about the best way. I'll be back next week, but until then, I've been Alan Bradley.
I've been Andrew Clues.
And safe motoring.